We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey everyone, before we get to episode 100 of Perpetual Chess, unbelievable 100 episodes, I have an exciting announcement. So you guys might have heard my interview with US Chess National Master and noted chess bookseller and adult improver Fred Wilson, where he mentioned that he used to have a chess interview show. Well, I'm happy to announce that we will be sharing the archive of this interview with my Patreon and PayPal supporters. So anyone who donates $3.50 a month or more, $3.50, not very much, will over time be able to hear the entire archive of Fred's old interviews. So thanks to Fred for working with me on this deal. And here are some of the people that you'll be able to hear. Some of them familiar to Perpetual Chess listeners. Some of them have not been on the show. There's GM Hikaru Nakamura, esteemed trainer GM Gregory Kaidanov, GM Maurice Ashley, Joel Benjamin, Bruce Pandolfini, Greg and Jen Chahati, all these old interviews from 10 to 15 years ago on Fred's old show. You also even get to hear from some chess dignitaries who are no longer with us, like Grandmaster Arthur Bisguire, I am Victor Frias, lots more. So I'm excited about this project because it's a way to give back to those who've supported me. I've said on the Patreon page before that the more I get in donations, the more I'm able to put into the show and the more I'm able to give back. And this is just the first chance I've had that I felt like I could do something to offer more to those who support me. So nothing is changing about Perpetual Chess itself. This is just an added perk for those who support me, who support the show. The plan is there's about 100 archived interviews in total, and we're planning to roll them out 2 per week over roughly 50 weeks. The interviews are unedited, so they kind of sound like you're listening on a radio or something. The audio quality is not awful, but it's not amazing either. And I'm not going to be able to do much editing, so you really get a sense of what it would have been like to listen when it happened 15 years ago, 12 years ago, whatever it was. On the one hand, that feels like a long time ago. On the other hand, it doesn't to me. But you get to hear these guests talk about their lives and careers as we do on Perpetual Chess, and also hear them reflect on things like different world championships that went on at that time. And Fred does book reviews of books that came out during that period, chess books, of course. So they're fun to listen to. So if you're interested and you were on the fence about donating to the show, maybe this will give you the little extra push. If you don't care, don't worry. This doesn't affect Perpetual Chess itself at all. We're still going strong. We're still coming out every week. There's lots more I hope to do over time to make it better. With continued financial support, I can do stuff like travel to interview guests. I can do stuff like provide transcripts and timestamps of shows. I would love to do all that stuff. So again, the more I get, the more I'm able to put in. But I also, of course, just want to express my gratitude to people who support the show. I mean, it's been 100 episodes, and this is basically a dream job for me, a dream side job. I mean, I love to talk chess, and I love to hear people's stories. So to make a little bit of money to do this is a wonderful thing, and I want to thank you all for your support. So sit back and enjoy this interview. It is with Carsten Henzel. Speaking of chess history, he's lived it over the past few decades. So I think it's quite interesting. And the last thing I wanted to mention is I'll be also releasing a couple of these interviews on the Perpetual Chess feed of Fred Wilson's old interviews. So you can listen in a couple weeks, check for that, and you can evaluate and see if you like it, or just ignore it if you feel like it's not your cup of tea. But at least then it's just free added content. So check it out and enjoy. And that is enough babbling by me. So please enjoy this episode, and I will catch you guys soon. Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We've got another guest that I am super excited for. I feel like I've been saying that every week lately, but it's true. And this one comes at chess from a different angle. He is a manager of Peter Lecoq and Vladimir Kramnik in the past, two names that our listeners will probably know well. He's also been a tournament organizer, and he is releasing a book imminently called Vladimir Kramnik, The Inside Story of a Chess Genius. It's been out in German, and now Quality Chess is releasing it in English, and I am really I read an excerpt, and I'm really excited to read the whole thing. So, Carsten Henzel, thank you for joining us here on Perpetual Chess.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ben.
So I was really excited to get to know more about Vladimir Kramnik's background through your book, and through that a little bit about your background. But why don't you begin by telling our listeners how you got to know GM Kramnik and how you eventually got to become his manager?
Yeah, it all started somewhere in 92. Vlad was playing in the Dortmund chess days. There was a very, very big open. He was here the very first time. He was 17 years old, so very young, talented, but not really known to the big chess world. And then he won that open tournament ahead of 541 participants, yeah, and I think 100 title holders were participating, and this was, of course, a very big breakthrough in 92, and even Gary was very excited, Gary Kasparov, who won the main tournament at that time. And yeah, and from that moment on, of course, everybody was focusing a bit more on this young guy, Vladimir Kramnik, from Russia, and including me, of course, yeah.
Yes, and that was around the time that he made his Olympiad debut as well, correct?
Yes, it's correct. Okay, let's say all this is, of course, written in the book. It's a story what was going on in the 90s, and I was trying in accordance with my possibilities to go as deep as possible into the content, but not too deep, because my main goal was to combine the story of Vladimir Kramnik with the recent chess history, considering the last 40 to 50 years in chess, and to combine this history with the story of Vladimir Kramnik, which I think is very, very important.
Yes, of course, being that he's a living legend, and if you tell the story of the history of chess over the past 30 years, his name will come up throughout the story. Could you tell, so I know the story a little bit about how Kramnik made his way onto the first Russian Olympiad team that he appeared on.
Yes.
But some of our listeners may not be as familiar, and I know you do touch on it in your book. So could you tell that story?
Yeah, of course I can tell. He was coming from Dortmund, and Garry Kasparov and others like the national coach Yuri Razuvayev at that time, they were really, really very excited, and they wanted to include him in the team for the Manila Olympiad at that time. But there was a big opposition because, at that time we had some 40 grandmasters playing in Russia, and Kramnik, of course, was not a grandmaster with 17 years. He had no title. He was not even an international master at that time. And and everything was, of course, a bit confused because the old guys didn't want to see him already. Yeah? And but they forced this, the mighty Kasparov and others. And by the end of the day, he, of course, had a fantastic result. And I think he got both titles, the international grandmaster, the international master and grandmaster title at the same time from the World Organization FIDE, parallel to the Olympiad in Manila. And, a big career started, then from the year 92 on, up to these days.
Yeah, and obviously it must have been an incredible boost to Kramnik's confidence to have none other than Kasparov vouching for him and saying, no, you have to put this lower-rated, relatively unknown guy ahead of all these titled Russian stalwarts, and then to go and deliver on fourth board is the stuff of legends. So you mentioned that you first encountered him at this tournament. What was your initial introduction on a personal level?
Yeah, okay. I his name I heard first in 92. We were in Reggio Emilia. This is a little town in Italy, and there was a big tournament, and Kasparov was playing and some other big guys. Arnand won it in 91 at that time, and we were meeting in the breakfast room, Mikhail Botvinnik, and he was speaking about Russian chess, about his chess school, and he mentioned that Vladimir Kramnik was the biggest talent in his school. And at that time, the tournament director of Dortmund, he made some notes, and he told the Russians that he really wanted to have this guy then playing in Dortmund. And this was the very first. I forgot him immediately because, so many names, so many chess players. I was a spokesman for this event, and then he was invited and had this success. And thereafter, he played the main tournament, the super tournament in 93, and we were speaking a little bit, and it developed through the course of the 90s, so I got to know him better, yeah.
Okay, and did you have experience as a manager at this time?
Yeah, well, I was involved in event organization, in sports management in general, but I was never active as a personal manager in chess. I was more coming from boxing, from table tennis, ice hockey a little bit, also German football. I was involved mainly in event organization in these fields, but not establishing a personal management. And I was not intending to do so.
And how did you initially become interested in chess?
Oh, okay. This already happened in the 70s, in the beginning of the 70s. It had, of course, something to do with the Fischer-Spaskim match. And I was getting some news in the German TV for the very first time. They presented chess on TV, and then I learned a bit the rules. I played as an amateur just for fun, like a hobby player. And of course, still I'm not a club player. I might have some 1,600 to 1,800 Elo, but I'm not really a club player. So I just it was just always a hobby for me. During the course of the 90s, when I was managing the Dortmund event, and trying to to establish a real professional tournament here in Germany, of course I was coming closer to the big guys. Yeah, just for instance, when I was negotiating all these contracts, and which I did also for the city hall on behalf of the city hall, and so I knew them better step by step. And it started all a bit with Leko, because Leko was like a family member from 92 on. He needed some help from time to time, and he was in my house, and he was part of my family. And I remember it was 98 when he was really struggling and had some trouble, so there was no way for him. He did not see a way how to proceed this kind of professional chess. Because you have to know, if you are a top 10 player, okay, it's easy. But if you are not, or if you want to go there, it's a very big thing. Yeah, and okay, you need money, you need sponsors, you need to invest in your training, partner, seconds or whatever. So so I started with him in 98, and okay, we were quite successful. And of course, parallel to this, Vladimir was speaking very often to me, and of course I knew some people which were good friends of mine and of Vladimir parallel, yeah, which were living in Moscow. And so it was coming closer and closer, and one day he was asking me to do something for him. In the first place, I did not do it for, let's say, on a professional basis, just as a friend. And okay, then he became world champion, and the situation were completely different then.
Okay, well, there's a lot from there that I'd like to get a few more details on, if you don't mind. Number one, so you mentioned, you told this story of Peter Leko feeling like he's struggling in 98 and having some trouble coming up with the finances in order to fund his pursuit of becoming, or ascending the ladder of becoming, even more elite. So when he came to you and you tried to help him, what sort of concrete steps would you recommend to someone in that situation?
First of all, of course, it is most important to find some backing, some sponsors, yeah, to really make you independent from anything else. Yeah. He was, I think he was, with 14, he was the youngest grandmaster at that time. And, okay, he had some income by playing summer tennis exhibitions. But for very little money, he was like a circus horse, yeah. So, and he could not really develop his chess up to his real potential, and also it is difficult. Just for instance, if you understand that you work with people which are not perfect for you, you have to change them possibly. Maybe you have to work with more than one or two or three people if you want to realize your potential. And this is professional chess, and these guys are grandmasters, and then you have to invest. And okay, this goes parallel to professional sponsorships, to let's say communication, professional communication business. You have to organize yourself a little bit. And I think nowadays, if I see these guys which are starting the world championship tomorrow, Carlsen and Ken Caruana, they had it almost from the beginning, but at that time, in the end of the 90s, this was quite different. Yeah, so I established something, and we found a big German energy company which are even acting on a European basis, so a very big company. And I was successful in negotiating a 5 years contract for Leko. It started in 98, and then we really had had some development from that moment on.
That's great. I mean, it's wonderful that you're able to find someone, and obviously those efforts paid off. Now, I'm just curious, so once you're in touch with Peter Leko and you're trying to help him, how do you reach out? I mean, I'm sure you have a network, but do you just call companies, or do you reach out to people you know? And was this agreement that you came to, was it like a public endorsement, or more, was it more like private support?
No, of course there was a network, but okay, I knew sponsors from other sports. I was organizing world championships in ice hockey, in boxing, and I think even in ice skating, and I knew this this company and their representatives already, and so I was coming into contact. And okay, the most of the people are not very are very competent, even not in the marketing departments of such companies when it comes to chess, yeah. And when they heard of what kind of amount I was asking for, they were quite surprised. They thought it was much more expensive. Yeah? At that time, we were talking, let's say, about $100,000 a year, and they said, "What? $100,000? This is not too much. What do we get for yeah. this money?" And okay, and by the end of the day, I can tell you, with them and Leko, we had really a lot of very successful events in Germany, in Hungary, in Budapest, etc., etc. Just for instance, they were organizing this match against Khalifman Alexander when he was becoming FIDE World Champion in 2000, or when was it, 2001 or 1999 in Las Vegas, yeah. And they were organizing the match against Leko, and Leko crushed him with 4.5 and 1.5, and it was perfectly organized. And then they saw what is possible. We had, let's say, in a better show match, which was of course rated for the list, but it was of course not a world championship match. They had something like 3,000 spectators. They had more than 100 journalists, and the internet started already at that time a little bit. They saw incredible traffic, which was not. Which we could let's say manage within 1 week. We had more than the company in 1 week in 1 year, and so they discovered chess a little bit for themselves, and it was quite a start. And from this time on, it was not so difficult for me to interest the sponsors to chess anymore. Yeah, because later on, even with Kramnik and again with Leko. There was quite often a necessity to get sponsorship into the business.
Well, that's great to hear, because we've had different boosters of chess on, people who, like, for example, the USCF president or heads of local organizations. And I know that some have had more success than others in terms of attracting corporate sponsorship.
Yeah, this is true. It is always a bit difficult. First of all, you need to be connected, and second, you have to understand how to sell a product. Chess is a product. It's quite different from ice hockey, just for instance. But okay, it's still a product, and you have to open exactly these doors. And of course, chess on the other hand is also has a great respect in the society, yeah, because of its history and its culture, and you can use all this. But by the end of the day, you have to show the data, yeah, the media data. You have to make certain communication possible for the companies involved. And if you are successful, let's say on two or three occasions, then it becomes more easier. Nowadays, I see a different picture. Of course, I understand that Magnus is a very attractive player from the West, from Norway, even to sponsors. Yeah, with other players, it is not automatically the case. But we should become more independent on this and really to sell the product chess and professional chess. And I think the new FIDE president, I'm really not involved in this business anymore, but it's a real big hope, because what FIDE did, let's say, the last 30 to 40 years was a disaster. Yeah, they are running the business like we did it in table tennis. This is my sport I'm coming from. We did this business in the 70s, yeah, for them it was still state of the art nowadays. And so this change was really, really necessary, and I hope for the best that it comes to a good development, because chess cannot do the same as football here in Europe, or let's say ice hockey hockey or basketball in the United States. But if we only get 1% out of this amount for our professional chess, then we would all be happy, and not only the top 10 players or the world champion.
Yeah, and it feels like chess is growing generally. There's more interest online. There's a lot of companies, grabbing market share and getting more people interested in chess. But the final leg is still that high-profile corporate sponsorship.
Yes, yes. This is true. First of all, you need to from my point of view, to deliver the right system. In my opinion, in accordance with my experience, the biggest asset what you have is a world championship match. Yeah, this has something to do with the history. This is the real big thing, and then of course you have to build the house from there. And this is done nowadays, but maybe you can still optimize something in the World Championships, in the Grand Prix series, even to connect the big private tournaments, to establish new tournaments in continents and countries where the people like chess, but nothing happens. Yeah. So, and if you have such kind of system, if you establish something very transparent, then of course you have a product and you can sell. But FIDE by now could not manage it at all.
Yeah, and what's your opinion of this sort of raging debate about the intellectual property of broadcasting an event like the World Championship? Like, I know you probably know to what I'm referring, but just for listeners, so FIDE feels like in being the one that organizes the events, it should have the exclusive right to show the moves as they happen. But companies like Chess.com and Chess24
of course, I understand FIDE very well, and even the players, because the highest courts in Moscow, and even if I remember well in my time in the United States, they were refusing that there are any personal rights on this, and that this is only an information, like a result. So as long as you will not find any main court who decides in a different way, there's simply no chance. There's simply no chance, and you have to find a different approach to all this. So we even were not able to establish a business plan. We were hoping very much that this would be possible one day, because then there would be a completely different market for the professionals, not for the chess lovers and for the spectators who are used to get everything for free.
Right.
But okay, it would be of course very, very important. And once if you want to see a movie over the internet via the internet, okay, you pay some $3 or $4 for it, and you won't mind after you did it 3 or 4 times, and so you are used to this, and it's not too much to ask for. We did it also in Bonn, 2008. I remember we were organizing the World Championship match Kramnik-Arnand, and Arnand was losing this match, but despite this, it was perfectly organized, and we were trying to set up this new system, FIDEOS. We had, 16 cameras, and you were in the driver's seat as a spectator, and you could use every camera. You had 9 grandmasters as commentators in different languages, and even animation, whatever we did. And we were really, I think, investing some 100,000 euros or dollars on this system. And, founding a company. And I can tell you, we had in our live broadcasting, for free broadcasting, we had some 1 million people in per game. But making them pay $5 for this kind of service, this was, I think we had some 100 or 120 people which were ready to pay. And okay, so it was clear that people are not ready if they get the moves on a different side for free. And this is the case right now. Of course, as far as I understand, FIDE was trying hard, and also Argon, yeah, their commercial arm. But okay, we're not very successful. So all remains the same. But okay, what you have to do, of course, is to present the events, to organize the events in the highest level, to attract sponsors, to bring the journalists again to chess. When I was organizing my last World Championship match, I did it 2008, and before in Brissago 2004, we had in Bonn, we had 420 journalists in the event, more than 400. And nowadays, there's a bit of tendency that people tend, or even the journalists tend, to sit in their living rooms drinking a cup of tea and following the games in the internet, and then, of course, making reports. As if they were there in the right venue, but they never were there. And the sponsors, look, nobody in the press center. And this is, of course, counterbacked from the negative sides from the internet. But okay, if you really organize a world championship match or a candidates tournament or even a big qualifier in a very, very professional way, so very high quality, then the spectators are coming, journalists are coming, you can organize this. The interest is still there.
Yeah, I think the interest is there for sure, and I agree with you. I'm generally not a big defender of FIDE, but I'm sympathetic to their plight in this case. I mean, they're putting on the product that draws the eyeballs, but unable to draw any revenue besides the people who buy tickets.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, okay. This is a professional ticketing system, which is normal in every sport. When we were staging the event in Bonn, which is by now known as the best organized world championship match ever. Yeah, and this is not from me. This is not my quote. These are really said from FIDE people, which were involved at that time. Until nowadays, so there was a ticketing system, and we were taking some 40 euros, so $50 for entrance, and we were sold out every day, and so we had all these journalists on top, yeah? So we had many thousands of people which were ready to pay this money for chess, and okay, there was a certain, let's say, a venue which is important. So we had always in mind to combine arts and chess. Yeah, this was our idea. There was a concept behind. When we were organizing a chess event, we were trying to have a certain message on this, to combine chess with its history, with the culture, with the society. And just for instance, in that match, we were in the Art and Exhibition Hall of the Federal Republic of Germany, and of course, you have synergy effects then. Yeah, you can bring target groups together and all these things. And there are many, many, many possibilities. Nowadays, the situation is even better. Yeah. Than in our time when Blatt was world champion. But okay, you need to have this concept first, and you need to have a professional commercial arm which covers all these fields.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. I mean, it's a thorny issue, but I do want to pivot to your book and talk a bit more about GM Kramnik, of course. So one question I had for you was, you mentioned in the excerpt I was able to read that you actually, as Vlad's manager, sometimes you would be involved in match strategy discussions in his world championship matches. So I was curious how that frames your thinking about the upcoming match, which will already be underway when people hear this interview.
No, I think I was quite clear in the book when it comes to chess. Let's say nobody could really interfere. Could really interfere. Vladimir made all his decisions concerning chess himself. I was organizing things which were necessary and which he wanted. I was his manager. But how the preparation would be organized in detail, who would be invited in his team or whatever. These decisions he made by himself. Yeah, and we had a very clear agreement. Yeah, that he is responsible for everything concerning chess, and me was more, let's say, my business was more to care about communication and the commercial side. Of course, we were speaking a lot during the matches and even before, and I have my own opinion on all these things, and I express them in my book, which are not necessarily the opinions of Vladimir, because I also I allow myself to criticize from time to time. Even him. But okay, if you write a book, you should have this. You should have this freedom, and he gave me.
Yeah. For example, again, I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but one thing I noticed is you talk about how in Kramnik's younger years he was a little bit freewheeling and maybe didn't have the total professional approach to chess. And
I'm sure he himself sees it possibly different. We are not talking about the book because he did not read it yet. Yeah, the English version is out. Let's say in 10 days or something like this, and then he will start to read it. But we were speaking, of course, a little bit, and of course he was contributing with the analysis of the most important games and etc. etc. And we are not always of the same opinion. But I express my opinion on him, even in this context. And in the 90s, to my taste, he was absolutely a genius already. Yeah? And he could have been a world champion even before 2000, I'm quite sure. This has been possible. But his approach to chess was always a bit different. If you compare it to the with the approach of Fischer or Kasparov, for example, yeah, he was not let's say he was not looking for the results in first place. He for him chess it was always more a process, an art, and he expressed himself via chess, and necessarily a good result was for him not the most important thing, yeah, for a time being. And okay, he was living his life like a bohemian. Yeah, he had a lot of fun. And I cannot judge really if he would have done differently but if his approach would have been a different one, if he would give everything into his chess and into his potential, then there would have been other possibilities already during the course of the 90s. A very good example, to my taste, is his loss to Shirov. Yeah, and okay, we were speaking once, I don't know, in a sauna somewhere about this match, and he told me, Carsten, I was in so bad shape. I made so big mistakes. I have no explanation for this, etc., etc. And he was trying to find all these reasons when something was going wrong. He was trying to find those reasons connected to his chess. But I think he did not consider that if you want to reach the highest goal, where the thin is very, very, where the air is very, very thin, yeah, in this level, that you have to be very professional in other areas as well. And at that time, during the course of the 90s, he was, of course, not.
Okay, and it's interesting that you do pinpoint that match with Shirov, which Kramnik lost, because it was only a few years later where he sort of turned the corner and really ascended to the highest level.
Okay, it was a shock. In my book, I was describing him when he had the opportunity to play Kasparov directly. Yeah? Okay, with Shirov, if he would have won against Shirov, he would also had this match. But okay, this was something different. Yeah, it was something different. And when he had Gary in front of him, it was like a shock. And I remember very well. Linares always took place in March, and I was coming 2000 into the breakfast room in Linares, and I saw him sitting in the breakfast room in the morning, 9:30 or 10, having breakfast. Yeah, this was not Kramnik. Kramnik got up one around noon. Yeah, but not 9 in the morning. And so it changed already. They were negotiating. He did not even sign the contract. But Anand was hesitating at that time, and so something was going on, and he stopped smoking when it was clear. I think he signed somewhere 5th of April or something like this, immediately after Linares, this contract, and you had a different person. You had really a different person who had a fantastic approach. He was in the best shape you could imagine. Bring himself into this shape physically but also mentally, and he was completely focused, and this was really something which for me is proof. If he would have done this 5-6 years earlier, he could have been world champion already in 95, 96, 97, yeah, if he would have started this in the 90s. But okay, this also shows something, yeah. To my taste, concerning his chess potential, it is clear that he is among the strongest player of all times. But the question is of if he was always ready to bring his very, very best potential to the road, no?
Yeah, and it sounds like your opinion is pretty clear on this matter. One thing I would just say is, It sounds like it could have been better. He maybe could have reached his potential earlier, but it could have been worse too. I mean, chess history is littered of examples with people who just never reached their potential to be truly elite.
Okay, so if you make certain people work hard, then of course it has drawbacks as well. This is, I think, also his opinion on this matter, but I have a little different one, and I allow myself to express it in the book. Still, yeah, even under the circumstances that he was not so result orientated all the time, he was 7 years world champion, winning 3 big world championship matches. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So another question I had for you is, I saw you sent me a link to an interview you did with Leonard Utz at one of the Olympiads, I believe, where you talked a little bit about this book after it had been published in Germany. And again, the book is called Vladimir Kramnik, The Inside Story of a Chess Genius. And you mentioned that the famous book From London to Elista, you felt there were some things that you didn't feel were portrayed accurately there. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
No, I don't want to go into details. There was just, let's say, some opinions were expressed from one of the authors. It was not Barev. Barev did a good job from what I can see concerning chess and the analysis of the games. But okay, when we are talking about Toiletgate and this scandal, the other author, he was expressing his opinion on this. He was not even there. And okay, I think in my book you can read 40 pages about this scandal, and I was there. And the good thing is I made notes in all my diaries, in my schedules. You cannot imagine, when I started writing the book, it's, let's say, my memory on all this, yeah, not only on Elista and the Topalov match, but from all concerning all what happened in the 90s and even 10 or 15 years ago, was sometimes completely different from the facts, yeah. And so we tend to change a bit our memories, yeah. Okay, so I was checking all my diaries, my schedules. I bring all, let's say, the interviews at that time together of what Vladimir said, so that I have it authentic, yeah, in conjunction with the moment when the things happened, and not only relying on my memory. Yeah. So this was the biggest work on the book to get. Okay, if you write, let's say, such a story of a person, and you combine it with, let's say, in this case, chess history, there might be always some inaccuracies and some views which are not in accordance with the views of other people. But you can. I was trying to be as objective as possible. Okay, I'm Kramnik's manager. I was Kramnik's manager. We're still very, very good friends. And but I wanted to be as objective as possible. And this you can only try when you go back to this actual situation. And if there are no documentation about it, very, very difficult. Yeah, because memory is changing all the time.
Yeah, they're fickle things, and it's definitely good foresight on your part to take so many notes.
Yeah, no, I made it as on a regular basis. When I started to manage Leko in 98, I had always my schedules were big calendars, yeah, and in the evening of every day I made some sentences on it, yeah. And what was very interesting, even I can tell you when I was with him driving to the venue in Elista game 6 or 7, we were talking about a certain Champions League game in football, because Vlad is really a football fan and follows all this. And I made a note in the evening, okay, and I could tell you we were talking about the game Moscow versus Hamburg, which Hamburg won 1-0 to Moscow. Yeah, so these little things, of course, you would not remember at all after all those years, but this shows that this is serious. Yeah, so I have all this material. I had this, and this was really worth. This was really a big value to me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading the whole chronology. So one question, and it's quite possible you cover this in the book, is you of course mentioned that you managed both Leko and Kramnik, and they played for the World Championship in 2004. So were you managing them both at that point?
Yes.
So
yes.
Was that a challenge?
Yes, this was the biggest challenge. You can believe me this. It was much bigger than toilet gate in Elista or other situations. First of all, when you're manager of both grandmasters, which play for the title, and then you are in this world, you are asked by everyone, okay, whom do you prefer?
Right. Yeah.
whom? First of all, they assume you are in a win-win situation. I never saw it like this, because I was always pretty independent on everything, so I could live with any result. And by now, I'm not clear in that question. I don't know. The one who was better should win. Yeah. This was okay. This was really, really the case at that time. But the biggest challenge was to realize this match at all. And it's a big story also in the book, because it connects to the situation in the world of chess at that time. Okay, we had the Prague Agreement, which is the story itself. And this was, okay, the legitimation to stage this match, or at least to make it easier, even from FIDE. But from this time on, they were fighting you all the time. FIDE and even Gary, okay, he was cooking his own soup, and you were against anybody. You stood against anybody in the world of chess, and then to realize such a match with, let's say, which a budget of 2-4 million is always needed for such big event, and to find somebody even not having official documents. Yeah, of course, we all knew Kramnik is the classical world champion. He defeated the champ, but okay, official sponsors, they look for something different, and you don't have. So this was really a challenge to get it together. Plus, we had a very weak rights holder. At that time, they were not really active, they were not competent, and okay, and still you cannot do something because they have the rights, yeah? This was very difficult. And when this match was on, this was the biggest relief in the whole story, yeah? Kramnik, when Vladimir, it's the story of Vladimir, not of Leko, when Vladimir were fighting in this match, there was also a different thing. He was not in his best shape, and this had reasons. But therefore people should read the book, because it's pretty exclusive what is going on, what was going on in Switzerland at that time.
Yeah, I can't wait to get all of the details. I had a few more questions for you relating to, you have so many little nuggets that you just sort of hint at during the excerpt that I read that left me wanting more. So you mentioned you considered the 1990s sort of a golden age for chess, and being that it was a more casual time because computers hadn't totally dominated preparation yet. Yeah, you tell stories of hanging out with people like Yusupov and Timon and
right.
players of that stature. Do you have any particularly memorable stories from that period?
Yeah, of course.
It's good when you start by laughing.
If you have time to talk with me 5 hours or so, I can talk a lot. No, in general speaking, it is clear that the computers changed the world of chess completely, and not only concerning the way chess is played nowadays, but also, let's say, changed the whole atmosphere. When it was more familiar, it was more romantic, if you want to say so. People were not analyzing all the time with their best friend, with their notebook, some variations. They were talking to each other. Yeah? It was more human. Yeah? This is very clear. We were sitting together during breakfast, all these big guys even participating and playing against each other. And they had some books with them and some notes. And then before the game, they were briefly checking in which direction they wanted to play. But that was all. And when the game was over, it was over. And most of the times, they were sitting together, drinking a glass of wine and talking about many things, not only necessarily about chess. And after the game, they had... still, there are analyses, which is there were special analyzing rooms in the venue, and it was very interesting for the journalists to follow all these possibilities, which they could discover post game. And all this is missing a little bit, but we have to accept time is changing. If I go to a tournament, last big tournament I saw was in Wijkaanzee in the Netherlands in the beginning of the year. You cannot see the players anymore. They are they finish the game, they go to their room, they eat dinner in their room, and then they check all the possible variations for the next game and opening scenarios. And computer making it possible on one hand, of course, but on the other hand, the human touch is missing a bit, I would say.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm not complaining. It should be good for something. Yeah, of course, you need to develop something. Even chess, you have to go through. Maybe it will change again one day. When people come to a completely different approach, because we are not playing computers, we are playing humans, and when they start to understand that they should differ a little bit from all this, and chess will even change again, who knows?
Yeah, and you do see some pictures I've mentioned before. You see reporters like Tarjei Svensson, sometimes he'll tweet pictures of Maxime Vachier-Lagrave and Aronian, and there's a couple others who like to get together and play board games late at night. So it's not a totally lost art, but I can definitely, if I were traveling at that time, I would have loved to have just had a few drinks and watched people analyze.
On the other hand, it should be said that many things are much better nowadays. Just for instance, they are... they are not big scandals. They do not do this, all this struggling all the time. Yeah, they are just friendly to each other. They behave like real sportsmen. Yeah, this is also something which we should not underestimate. Coming back to all these scandals in the past, it might might be interesting from time to time for some general public, but if you are involved in such scandals, it's not so easy. You know, it's not so nice, yeah? Because it's also a violation all the time of what happened. And if these big egos have that kind of approach, it's a different story. I prefer, let's say, what in this field, I prefer what they are doing nowadays, to behave like sportsmen and to have respect and to be fair when they play each other. Yeah. So not all is bad nowadays, of course.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of which, you tell the story of meeting Bobby Fischer in the book. Could you share that story with our listeners?
Yeah, it's not very personally. I met him on one occasion in Budapest, and he was in Europe. He was like a ghost. Nobody knew really where he was, but I knew that Leko was meeting him from time to time. He was even guest in Leko's family, so I knew he was in Hungary. And one day when Leko played the match in 2000, I remember 2000 against Khalifman, somebody called me and offered me the possibility to meet Bobby, and I did in Budapest in a cafe, and I had one or two sentences with him. But he was very shy, and he was not convinced that I was really the manager of Leko at that time. He was afraid that I was somebody else, yeah, like a CIA agent or whatever. So it was not so easy with him, but okay, he was living in his own world, and he might have some reasons to be very careful, I don't know. But it was a bit strange. It was a very, very short meeting, and that it was. Yeah. Later on, there was a proposal one day that Kramnik should play against Fischer in a Fischer random match. This story is also in the book. We did not meet him. Vladimir always wanted to meet him. Even in his last years, he wanted always to go to Reykjavik. But something happened always, so he could not realize. And okay, in January 2008, Bobby was dying, and all the possibilities were gone. Yeah. So there are some little stories concerning Bobby Fischer in the book, of course, because when I wrote the book, I was always thinking, what is the connection of Vladimir's story to the chess history? Yeah? And just for instance, when he was born in 75, there was a match intended in Manila. Yeah, this was the match Karpov versus Fischer, and okay, it did not happen, but this was the year Vladimir was born. So I was trying to connect all these things a little bit, and to have this chess history included. And in the end of the book, in the appendix, Vladimir speaks about his colleagues, about all the world champions a little bit, giving some hints to their style and his opinions for their concerning their contribution for the chess development. Yeah,
the 1975 Karpov Fischer match, one of the great what ifs in chess history.
Yeah, possibly. So okay, Vladimir is still the opinion that Fischer would have been the clear favorite, but he also told that he was a lonely wolf at that time. And okay, Karpov was full of energy, he was young, and to do something in the openings, this would have been his only chance, so to say. But he considered Fischer to be the favorite. He told in that interview, he told once he had a certain moment where nobody could do anything against him, but this moment almost every world champion has once in his career, a certain period when they are so strong that they are really dominating. And okay, Vladimir might have had this problem, this form against Gary. And on certain occasions, he was, of course, able to live us his very best chess, even under tremendous pressure when you just think about the 14th game against Leko or this tiebreak against Topalov. But Fischer, of course, he was a colossus in this.
Yeah,
he was a tank.
Yeah. Okay, and one other story I wanted to draw out of you was you talk about meeting legendary Argentinian GM Miguel Najdorf.
Yeah. Miguel Najdorf I met in 1996 in Buenos Aires. No, not in Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires, I did not meet him. I met him in Yerevan, in Armenia, during the Olympiad 96. Okay, this was the occasion when we were speaking, let's say, 1 hour in a cafe. It was a very nice man who had to tell a lot of stories from the old chess world, from the very romantic times. Yeah, and I remember Vasily Ivanchuk was sharing this meeting, and we had some fun. He was trying to convince Najdorf in his own variation and in his own opening systems for new ideas, but Najdorf was not very interested. he was more busy with his meal. Yeah, it was quite funny.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, Najdorf would have been 65 or so at that point. So
no, I think he was more than 80 already. No?
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I think he was quite. Quite aged, so more than 80. I don't know exactly. He died some years later, and I was very happy to have the possibility to meet him during my years in professional chess, as well as I did with Botvinnik and Smyslov. And this is something or even with Bobby Fischer, even if it was only a handshake or two sentences. When you are so busy as I was. Then of course you do not think about now. I know that this was very, very special, and I try to express it in my book.
And I can't wait to get all the details. And I just have one or two more questions. And one is I wanted to read you a quote that you wrote about Vladimir Kramnik, because a lot of our listeners, we're huge fans of chess, but we'll never have the access and get to know the personalities of these people. So you write, "The way that Vladimir Kramnik plays chess is how he conducts himself away from the board. Sometimes chaotic, sometimes emotional, sometimes brilliant, but consistently authentic." So I was just curious if you could elaborate on that. Is he present when you have a conversation with him, or is he more one of these geniuses who's always, the wheels are always spinning a little quicker than the conversation?
No. Vladimir, first of all, he has many, many interests. As I told you, he likes football. He could have been himself maybe even a professional football player. He was very, very good in defense. Yeah, and he's interested in many things. Yeah, in arts, and I don't know. He has a lot of hobbies and interests. He's not like some players which are always thinking, okay, sometimes he expressed it's a problem for him. When he really is involved in something, let's say if he prepares the World Championship, or like, okay, then it starts to cover everything a bit, yeah? But he was always, he had a different approach. He was not married with chess 24 hours. This is clear. But he has a certain approach. He believes that chess and the style expresses the character of a person. Yeah, he's somebody who plays active positional chess, and he has a brand mark on this. And he, even in the book, he describes other big players and is making, let's say, some examples so that everybody can understand what he means in this. So he has a certain approach, and he sees chess in a certain way, but he's not 24 hours a day busy with chess. He has two children, he has a wife, they are all living in Switzerland, and I know sometimes nowadays when he plays chess, his biggest problem is that he is away from the family. Yeah,
yeah, I can definitely relate to that, and I'm sure many of
and this is a big point. Yeah, Because if you devote yourself to chess 100%, then of course you might be even stronger, but you miss many things on the other hand. But that he brings it all together with two little children and a nice wife and traveling and playing chess, still top 10 player in his age, this already shows something. Yeah.
And speaking of his other interests, you also mentioned in the book, and I don't know how much you can say about this, but you mentioned that he'd had other offers to sort of move away from a career as a chess professional. Are you able to say any more about?
No, when I was his manager, he had a lot of contacts to sponsors. Yeah, he was engaged by celebrity speakers, and whenever he did this business, of course people were focusing on this guy. He could be a fantastic ambassador to their company, yeah? And he had, of course, or still has these possibilities. But Vlad is also, let's say, a pure chess player in one. He loves chess. And in my opinion, as long as he loves chess, and if this does not take too much energy from him, and if he, let's say, can compete with dignity. This is what is very important, because he is somebody. I don't think it is so nice if you are once the number. If a Kramnik would be once number 500 in the world, I think if he can play with a certain dignity on a certain level, and if he proceed like this, I would love to see him playing chess, because from my point of view, this is what he can do best, yeah, from all the possibilities he has. Of course he has. Just for instance, I also think he would be a fantastic representative of FIDE, or even of a commercial arm of FIDE, because he has a personality like Vishy Anand and some people who really can do something, yeah, in this. But okay, as long as these guys like to play chess, they should play, because this is what they really can, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to be that special at more than one thing. And obviously, he's still creating beauty on the chessboard. So I agree that I hope he sticks with it.
It's also not easy to say. When I was in Berlin, when he was playing the candidates tournament, everybody was praising him for his innovative and crazy chess. Yeah. But okay, he still wants to win. He doesn't want to be number five in the candidates tournament. Yeah, he wants to win it. Or this a little bit contradicts. Of course, he's doing what he wants in chess, but sometimes, of course, when he plays such a competition, he also wants to have a good result. To my taste, it was good. To his taste, I don't think he was very happy with being. I think he was fifth in this candidates tournament in Berlin. And just to say, he plays for the pleasure of all the chess fans. He did this, but I would wish that he would win such event once more, yeah, because he plays also a little bit for this nowadays, and he is able to do, but in Berlin, unfortunately, he was not, and there are not so many opportunities anymore than he had them in the past.
Yeah, and taking chances as he did in the game does make for some entertaining
chess.
Yeah,
I remember this game against Caruana. Yeah, I think he was clearly winning and then losing track, and this is, was a key game in this tournament. Winning this game could have made a completely different story in Berlin. And okay, this is of course something when you're becoming older and know that the energy is going down and that the opportunities are not that much in the future. Then the pressure is coming. But I saw even after the tournament, he likes to talk about chess. He likes to play. And okay, now he played, I think, in Isle of Man, a decent, very, very good open with an almost 2,800 performance. So he's still a fantastic and great player. And if he likes to do this, he should do.
Yes, for sure. And I can't wait to read even more details about this fascinating genius of chess. My last question for you, Karsten, is I don't know if you have any favorite chess books or books about your career as a manager and organizer, but I do always ask my guests for book recommendations of any sort.
Yeah, okay, but this is difficult for me. First of all, I don't know the title of the book in English. It was a book from Harald Schoenberg from New York. He published this book in the 70s, and the German title was Die Großmeister des Schach, the Grandmasters of Chess. But I think in English it's a bit different, this style. It is something like The Kings of Chess. This book, independent from the TV shows here in Germany connected to the Fischer-Spassky match in 72, this book really bring me to chess. And I know there are a lot of inaccuracies in this book, and the history of this book ends with a Fischer-Spassky match. But this fascinated me much. Yeah. This is a very old book, and you cannot even maybe you can still buy it. I don't know exactly, but this I would recommend for everybody who wants to read something about chess history, because the Stalin. It's just fantastic. It takes you in, yeah. And nowadays, let's say I'm not reading real chess books, but what I can recommend are the books of Artur Yusupov. He has a certain learning system, and even me, which was, let's say, a 1,300-400 player, it was possible to improve my chess to 1,600 to 1,800 within 1 year. Yeah, it's a series. I do not remember the name, but everybody can check out. It is Artur Yusupov's education books. Yeah? It starts with beginners up to professionals. This series is just fantastic. It's even, I think, recommended by FIDE. One good thing they did in the past.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I get recommendations from guests every week, and Yusupov's books have come up quite often. So I'll put a link to those in the show description. Of course, I'll also put a link to your book, and we'll try to track down the title of the Harald Schoenberg book to which you refer. I have a feeling that
you know the author. Hmm?
Well, I know the name, but I can't. Okay. I was trying to find a reference to it online just briefly, and I wasn't able to, but we'll keep digging. And if I can't, one of our listeners will, and then it'll make its way to the show notes. So a final question for you, Karsten. I don't know if you prefer to keep a low profile or if people who enjoy this interview wanted to reach you would be able to, but do you have any sort of social media or email address that you'd like to share, or would you rather keep that private?
Yeah, you can publish my email address. That's not a problem.
Okay, and I have it, so I'll just go ahead and put that in the show notes for anyone interested. And I just want to thank you so much for your time and for taking the time to write this book. I can't express how excited I am to read it, and obviously the timing is great with the World Championship upon us.
There are three translators in Quality Chess. They did a real good job. It was sold in Germany very, very well. It was, let's say, one of the best sellers in Russian biographies and, of course, in chess books for 3 or 4 months. So in Germany, the editors are very, very happy. And then Quality Chess was doing a real good business. From what I could see, they were working with 3 guys on the translation. It's not easy to meet the style, yeah, if a book is translated. But from what I really can see and judge, they did a good job. And I can recommend.
Of Excellent. Yeah. Okay, and the book may or may not be out when this interview comes out, but listeners, keep an eye out. It's coming very soon to Quality Chess and their app and all of that stuff. So, okay, so thanks again, Karsten. I really appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your stories and experience.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ben. Wish you well.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes my esteemed producer, Matthew Passy, and Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music, and everyone who's put in a good word for the show, whether it be on a podcast platform like Apple Podcasts or telling a friend or anything like that. As you guys know, I spend a lot of time on the show, probably about 5 hours a week between the research and the booking guests and the social media and the actual interview. I love doing it, but it can be hard to find the time. which brings me to the financial support. I want to give special thanks to those who contribute to the show. Extra special thanks to Chessable.com for their generous support. And I also want to thank, as always, my Patreon and PayPal perpetual partners. You are Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Ali Morchetti, Andres Quizdwa, Brian Mullis, Carl Labons, I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Bill Moran, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Chabri, Chris Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel D. Schaefer, Daniel Vine, David Cramley, CEO of Chessable.com, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I am Elect Donnie Ariel, Frank Tortoris, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, I am Greg Shahadi, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Augard of Quality Chess Publishing, James Bonastia, Jason Woolham, Jennifer Valens of OffTheRook.com, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Hartman, John Jernigan, WGM Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, Johnny McMenamin, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kuvyutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Leo Delgado, Lorraine Dore, Lucio Casada Silva, Matthew Passy, Macaulay Peterson, Martin Habish, Matthew Tedesco, Nate Solon, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Swaney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek, Robert Steiner, Ryan Berg, Ryan Sohn, Steiner Lima, Stuart Katz, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tchenko, Tim Brennan, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancourge, Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks a lot, everyone. Catch you guys next week.
Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.